I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, 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 welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Starting a business on your own can be lonely and worrying. Selling online multiplies this issue tenfold. Getting expert help is a great way to reduce anxiety, wasted time, and confusion. The Amazing FBA Mentoring Program is in its fourth year of helping sellers to get started on Amazon. By now, we have former clients who have, starting from scratch, done six figures and even in one case, seven figures a year. Obviously, these are not typical results. These are exceptional people. Nevertheless, we can help you get launched faster, safer, and with a much higher chance overall of success. With clients from Melbourne, Australia, to Manchester, England, we bring a genuinely international perspective. To find out more, go to amazingfba.com/mentoring. Thanks for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. This is your host, Michael Veazey. A delight to be here as ever. Always love doing interviews, much better than sitting there stuck in my own head. And I would advise you to also get out and interact with people. But the best thing you can do, the second best thing, is to listen to good podcast interviews. Today, I'm interviewing a fantastic guy, Kevin Anderson from Maximizing E-commerce. Maximizing e-commerce helps people grow their Amazon e-com businesses internationally, which is always a very, very interesting topic. Kevin's also the host of a podcast and YouTube channel of the same name. So Kevin, warm welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. And I definitely have to parrot what you just said there about connecting with other people. You know, I think too often we get stuck behind our keyboards and we forget that there's people involved in the whole internet. That's why I love doing podcast interviews like this and getting to chat with fantastic people like yourself.
Yeah, me too. And through whatever medium, I don't think it matters, but like real conversation, pick up the phone, do a Zoom call, Skype, whatever, get yourself like go crazy and actually get on a train or a plane and get to a meeting. But I really, really agree with that. Yeah, real connection is where it's at. So great, let's get started. So international selling, really from the US perspective, obviously I've got quite a sort of global perspective because basically in the UK, the market's small enough that we tend to start by looking early at the US market. Mm-hmm. Amazon.com, and if you're importing from China, it's the same difference anyway, at least that's my opinion. But this is the US perspective. So let's talk about Europe, first of all, from the US perspective. Let's start with the biggest picture questions. I mean, first of all, as an American-based seller yourself and somebody who helps American sellers to expand internationally is their main focus, is it even worth going to Europe? Or another question would be, when should you consider going into Europe?
That's a great question. So I think going into an international marketplaces, if you're already selling on Amazon.com, just makes sense. Because just to take a step back, I did it pretty early on. Like I had one SKU and I had four more like in the pipeline when I registered to go into Canada. And I've tried all kinds of different things like, you know, creating my own Shopify store, going on Etsy, going on eBay, going in all these other different places. And sometimes we think like, oh, I'm diversifying my revenue streams by going to these places and they're great. And I think we should all try these things. But then I realized, wait, I'm actually doing better going internationally. So for my sales in the US, I'm tacking on another about 30% by selling in international marketplaces. So for someone, back to your original question of, does it make sense to go into Europe? I would say yes. Now, if you're selling in .com and you're not familiar with Europe, because I know some of your audience is in Europe and some is in North America, but if you're already in Europe, it makes sense to just go into Europe as the next stop because you're already familiar with Europe and how things work. But for people in North America, I think that is like this dirty word. It's just like, oh my gosh, it just sounds so intimidating. But it's really not that complex once you kind of figure out like how it all works. So once you get kind of the gist of how that works and when you're responsible for that, it's actually not that difficult. But I think it's better to start for someone who's maybe in North America to start in Canada. But whenever they've, let's say, done Canada, or someone that lives in Europe and they're ready to go into their home of Europe, Europe is a great place because you tend to get more sales than you would in other international marketplaces. And the nice thing too about Europe is really you have five marketplaces you can go into and theoretically only import into one country. So I think it's great to go internationally. And I think it's one of those things that people go after the shiny object of trying to get sales off of Amazon, whereas you already know how Amazon works. And so if similar products are already selling in Amazon's international marketplaces, it's like, why not just throw them up there, so to speak, send in some inventory. It doesn't have to be huge numbers, but at least start getting some data and testing it out.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of our instincts as offline beings, i.e. for nearly all of human history until about 10 minutes ago, like in evolutionary terms, it's a microsecond ago, that we've been geared to ways of thinking. And even our education system has been geared to the physical world, which works in certain ways. For example, human beings don't tend to be 50 feet tall and whatever. So it's very easy to put barriers in places that made sense until about 5 seconds ago, which is Canada's further away than, you know, say, if you're based in New York, that Canada's closer. Okay, so Britain is further away than, you know, running a Shopify store or running a retail store down the road. So it might feel instinctively that the further away equals more difficult and less successful. And that would make sense in the physical world, but it just doesn't apply at all. Once you're getting products which are also physical, there is a physical limitation. But if you think about the globe for a second, if you think you're eight times, you know, and if you're in the West Coast, you're eight time zones behind London, or London's eight time zones ahead. And then China is seven, or now it's eight time zones ahead, I think, depending on whether it's daylight saving kicks in or not. I can't remember at this stage of the year. I always get confused.
At some point in time, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's basically a third of the globe. So you basically, if you're going from China to North America or China to Europe, it's the same difference in terms of costs and time and difficulty in some ways. So yeah, I my experience and that of so many other people mirrors yours, which is that, you know, Shopify or whatever is a way, way bigger leap. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but it's a whole different thing. Whereas Amazon is an immediate, obvious thing. So if you, especially if you're starting out, but even if you're just doing really well and expanding, it's still the obvious play. So yeah, I think we overcomplicate things by doing what is apparently simple based on real world instincts, whereas the online instincts need to be completely changed, because the online metrics that matter aren't physical distance or even different language, which is another barrier that people come up with, right? We'll talk about that. But I think it's conversion rates and traffic, which is a totally different lens through which to see the world, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing of it is, you know, when you have, like, let's say your own Shopify store, you know, to your point, you're having to generate your own traffic. It's yeah. not like the movie Field of Dreams where you build it and they will come. Like, you yeah. really have to send people there. You might get one or two sales just kind of happening from SEO, but like, you have to be real intentional about getting people there. Whereas with Amazon, Amazon's bringing people to your listing pretty much automatically. Again, if your product is selling in the US and similar products are selling in international marketplaces, it's at least worth trying. Because the reality is, while someone's listening to this podcast, someone somewhere in the world is typing in a keyword that's just like how they would type it into Amazon.com in like Amazon.ca or Amazon.co.uk, or they're saying it in German, whatever that, you know, translation would be, on Amazon.de. And they're buying their competitor's product, but they would have bought the listener's product had they been having it available for sale in that marketplace. So they're losing out on sales that they should be getting just because they haven't added the listing and sent in some inventory to do FBA. And I agree with you that people make it more complex than it needs to be. So I'm going to swing the pendulum the opposite direction and say this. If someone has a driver's license or a passport and has passed, at least here in the States, what we would refer to as sixth grade, they have the technical abilities required to sell internationally. And I'll explain why that is here in a second. So the forms to like fill out to get, you know, VAT registration in the UK, at least, because it's in English, or in Canada to fill out, you know, to get what's called a business number to register for their sales tax, which is called GST HST. It's no more complicated than the form you fill out to get a passport or driver's license. And the nice thing is we're talking about countries that are all based on English common law. So how things kind of work is all pretty much the same. They may call things different, but like the general flow of how you register for things and how the government works, you kind of can figure it out pretty quickly, especially the fact it's all in English. And the part about the sixth grade math is one of the things that trips people up. Well, I'll say two things trip people up. One is government stuff, which we just talked about. The forms really aren't all that complicated. And then two, it's the money part. And because people get real like, oh my gosh, like it's different money. Well, at the end of the day, the symbol for British pound, you know, or euro just looks different than a dollar sign. But at the end of the day, it's just numbers. And so my sister, oddly enough, is a principal at a elementary school. So, you know, for children, kindergarten through sixth grade, as we would refer to it in the United States, she oversees that and she oversees math and all the other subjects. And I asked her one time, I said, okay, let's say you have a child and we were to say to them, $1 in the US is, let's say, 75 pence in British pounds, or you know, whatever the math worked out to. So 20 US dollars is how many British pounds? What grade level would be able to figure that out? And she goes, oh, that's sixth grade, because that's literally just sixth grade level math. It's just basic ratios. And oftentimes we overcomplicate it. But at the end of the day, there's strategies you can do to maximize your returns and minimize some of what you may have to pay in conversions. But at the end of the day, you're getting access to new customers that you wouldn't have had access to otherwise had you not gone onto some of these international marketplaces. I mean, it totally is worth it. You know, this day and age, we think that, you know, to your point earlier, that there's these walls, you know, that we've put in our head that we can't go out of, but it's very simple. The days were, you know, if you had a brick and mortar store and if you wanted to expand to the town next to you, you have to get another lease, you have to hire more staff, you have to get all this other inventory. Whereas you could theoretically take the same orders that you're ordering now from your supplier and just split them up into different countries. And really you're selling through your inventory faster. And the only thing that's really preventing us oftentimes is just the soft matter between our ears.
Yeah, right. A lot of problems begin and end in our heads quite often, don't they? Okay.
Yes.
So thank you for clarifying this. The two things block people from starting: forms and money. The forms are no more complicated than getting a driver's license in the States, and the money is kindergarten math. And it agreed with that. But presumably there are some other blocks. So before we get into that, I guess let's boil it down. I want to look in a separate episode at the sort of rarer marketplaces, at least from the British perspective, okay, of Canada and Australia. But let's focus on Europe for now, because there are some commonalities. So I guess the first question is, what you're saying is go for the common law English-speaking countries initially, right? So I guess UK and Canada, presumably, if you're based in the States, is that what you'd basically start with?
I would recommend it just because tax is very similar, like sales tax. Technically, you have two different types of taxes generally. Now, I'm not a tax professional, but just from my own meandering experience and helping other people, what I've learned is really you have two buckets of taxes. You have sales tax and income tax. Generally speaking, if you have the company that in your home country, whether that's the UK or US or Canada or wherever, you can take that company and register in the other countries that you're going to go sell into. And then you're going to owe that income tax based on your sales, which your accountant can figure out for you, what you owe to your home government. And then the sales tax you owe to whatever government you're in. So that whether that's sales tax in the US, now that US is the most complicated country when it comes to sales tax. You can talk to 10 different sales tax experts who are lawyers with, you know, impressive credentials, and they're probably going to give you 12 different answers as to what you should do with your own situation, let alone in general terms. Then in Canada, it's just one time a year that you're generally most people will file, which we'll go into in a separate episode. And the nice thing is both countries, the US and Canada, you're adding on top of the selling price, whereas it gets a little more complex when you're managing into your margins, because VAT is generally speaking in, it's included in the selling price. So that trips a lot of people up in the States. is the VAT part. But the
You're
nice thing
wrong
is
once, without that. Yeah. Yeah. VAC seems to be the biggest single thing that I've found freaks out American sellers. I've worked with some very accomplished and confident and successful American sellers who maybe it was just a reflection on how badly I explained it, but they just didn't get the VAT thing after I went into it in great detail. Maybe it was the amount of detail that was the problem. So we'll come back to that in a sec, but I just want to summarize. I want to, first of all, congratulate you on a nice, simple summary of, you put it very neatly that I've not heard that way. So income tax is basically something you pay to your own government, wherever you are, and sales tax is broadly what you pay to the government of the country you're selling in, wherever that is. So that's a neat distinction. And you're so right about sales tax. We've had two experts on to talk about sales tax, both have a good claim to be legitimately pretty expert, and they both seem to come up with extremely opposite views of what you should be doing. So it's absolutely true, yeah, that there is no complete common ground. But if you're American and you're selling in America, you've already got that problem. So that could be very easily argued to be a very, very good reason to go abroad, right? Because you don't have Donald Trump deciding on the basis of tweeting after months of negotiation, just crashing through the process of due process and going, okay, well, we're going to raise import duty by 25%. So that doesn't happen. And also, you don't have to deal with US sales tax array, because it's just, it's so simple compared to that. VAT is simple compared to US sales tax. So trust me, having looked into both recently in great, great depth with my guests and with members of the mastermind who are sweating to deal with it and what have you, let alone my own thoughts. I mean, yes, so there's great reasons to not worry. If you're going to worry about anything, folks, if you're American, you should be worried about America, because you have quite a complex situation right now with taxes. Oh, yeah. Import taxes and sales taxes, not even talking about income tax or corporation tax. That's a separate issue. So good reasons to go abroad. It's not going to be more complex, I suspect. It's going to be simpler. But let's talk about going to the UK then, because this is obviously
a
great starting point. So let's talk about VAT. So as an American, you seem... you are American. I'm not insulting a Canadian by calling him American. I know this is...
No.
Terrible thing to do.
Been in the States my whole life.
Yeah, yeah. And you're deep down in Florida, I know. So you're way away from the Canadian border. But so, nevertheless... you're an American and you're not fazed by VAT. This is, in my experience, quite unusual. So what's your take on VAT from an American perspective? What's your simple non-accountant, non-UK take on it? Why is it not so scary? And how have you got to that happy position?
Great. Yeah. And I'll try to make it as simple as possible. And again, you know, take everything I'm saying really more as the beginning of research and not as the this is all the exact way to do it and understand it. But the simplest way to think of it is, and Americans can probably relate to this, because most of the time, as an American, we go into the store, we buy things, whatever it says there on the shelves, you know, or on the price tag or whatever, we're going to pay above and beyond, whether that's 6%, 8%, whatever it is for wherever we're at. Well, we're all used to this. Let's say we're at a ball game, we'll just use soccer, or as you would say in the UK, football, not to be confused with American style football, but the analogy actually here is going to work for both styles of football. So let's say we're at our seat, we're watching a game of our favorite sport, our favorite team, and some guy goes walking down the steps wanting to sell us a beer. And we're like, that sounds great. So let's just pretend that beer is 8, whatever currency points that is, whether it's dollars, pounds, whatever. Included in that is some form of sales tax. So in the US, if you're at the Miami Dolphins game, in Miami, and you buy a beer for $8, which might be a little generous as to how low the price would be, but let's just say it's $8. That technically is not $8 that the house, so to speak, that the stadium is keeping. It's going to be basically, it's really, let's say it's 8% sales tax in Miami. So that would be really 108% of the selling price. So they have to back out the 8% sales tax, and then they owe that to, which would be the Florida Department of Revenue, for example, there. So in the UK, everything is like buying a beer at a stadium. The sales tax is already included. And once you start figuring that out, it starts to make more sense. And we can dive a little bit more into this, but there's credits, There's ways of making it even more simplified. You're not having to worry about all the credits. It just depends on your situation and what makes the most sense. But we can dive more into that. But hopefully that at least makes it simple for people of how it actually flows, that it's just included in the price. So it's one of those things you just got to keep in mind.
Very interesting. And I think for British European listeners or non-American listeners, that's an interesting insight into American life and the relationship with sales tax, because I had no idea about that, because obviously I focus very much on e-commerce and online sales generally. I'm not used to the idea. If I understand correctly, you go to the store, then if you buy something for, say, a dollar, you're expecting to pay $1.08 or whatever. Once you get to the cash register, whereas if you get it in a stadium or some particular kinds of places, then it's already included. Is that right? It's different in different situations.
Yeah, generally what it is if it's cash involved. So like if you're at a stadium, you know, the guy who's got the big tub of beer, it would be very complicated to like figure out the math, like, oh, you had three, so let's figure that out. And they pull out a calculator or something. Sometimes, you know, it gets simpler when now that people have, you know, Square or whatever, that you can just swipe on a credit card on a phone. But for the longest time, and it still happens today, where people, if it's a cash type of environment, they try to keep it very simple. And that oftentimes includes the taxes in it. So stadiums tends to be one of those places where sales tax is included.
You see, it's so funny, isn't it? With whatever you get used to feels sensible, normal, and non-scary. Because to me, that just sounds enormously complicated. Like if I pick something off the shelf, I want to know how much it's going to cost me as a consumer. Bearing in mind, I'm not a business. If I ask, for example, for room hire for a meeting room that I'm booking in for the mastermind, I expect to have VAT added, right? Because it's a business situation. But if I'm buying, a beer for, you know, say a case of beer for $10, or I don't know how expensive the beer is, it sounds like a lot of money. But let's say I buy, you know, a couple of beers in a pub in Britain for, you know, the equivalent of $10. I don't expect to suddenly have that made into, you know, $11.35 randomly, you know.
Right,
so that
exactly.
Sounds weird. So yeah, it just goes to show whatever you're used to is what you feel comfortable with. And in the end, you just, from my perspective, from the consumer's perspective, the UK version is simpler, which is if VAT is added to something, that's what I pay as a consumer. As a business owner, you need to be very, very clear. And by the way, this is true if you use UK-based suppliers for anything at all, including potentially, for example, photography, or if you're getting returns sent to a warehouse in the UK or something, you should be very aware that you need to ask any fees or charges that they quote to you, ask them if it includes VAT. That's my main hint to you there, because it's not a guarantee that they will or won't. They may assume that you'll know that this is going to have VAT added, and they may assume the other way around. It's not, there's no kind of absolutely fixed convention within the business world. So small hint there. Be a major hint. I mean, VAT is normally 20% if it's charged. So that's quite a big increase in the price. So be careful with that one, Americans. But yeah, that's interesting that you say that. So one other thing I would point out is that not all goods have VAT added to them. I mean, some things are exempt, and there's always a big political football. You know, for example, some ladies' hygiene products have VAT added, which is widely seen as pretty unfair. And I would agree with that broadly. But then governments and taxes rarely have much to do with fairness, do they? They have a lot to do with politics.
Exactly.
But so there's another little caveat that I would say for Americans listening is don't assume that your product has to have VAT added. I mean, most cases it will do, unfortunately, but you should just double check. And again, you've got to have to get yourself an accountant at some point. As you say, this is very much not an accountant's view on either side of this debate, but
yes.
I think it's very good to have an entrepreneur's take on technical subjects like law and accountancy, because we need to get some common sense to get us over the hurdle of the mental hurdle, as you say, the stuff between our ears. And then we can just employ an expert if you're worried about it. And you know, guess what? There's a ton of British-based accountants who will speak perfectly good English that you can understand, and who will be incredibly familiar with VAT. They may not be so familiar with importing from China, but that's not that unusual either. So it's not hard to find an accountant who can deal with that. If you're trying to find some guy based in, I don't know, Kentucky, who is familiar with US sales tax and British, you know, VAT systems, that's probably asking a lot. So I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, be prepared to have different experts for different parts of your business. I mean, what do you personally do, Kevin? Have you found that you or your clients use different accountants, for example, for different parts of the world? Or do you just stick with one accountant for everything? How do you handle that side of things?
Let's say you go to the doctor and, you know, if you need to get surgery, you're not going to go to a doctor who handles feet if you need heart surgery, because you know you want the right doctor for the right situation. Well, people in accounting are kind of like that too. So I use my CPA here locally to do my income taxes. So CPA is a certified public accountant, basically in the States, who does your taxes for you. And then I use a VASC, which is a company based in the UK, that they do my VAT for me, because I want someone that understands VAT. And then I have another accountant who does my Canadian returns. And oddly enough, he's actually in Texas, but he understands the Canada system pretty well. So, you know, you want to have some specialists. You don't want to go too generalist on stuff like that, unless they truly have a background in all of that. But to your point, oftentimes the person who does US-based accounting is not going to understand VAT. Nor should they, and nor should you expect them to. They might have a basic understanding of it, but not enough to like understand the nuances, as you had pointed out.
Yeah, exactly. That makes a lot of sense. And thanks for being clear and straightforward about that, because I think a lot of people get blocked in life because they're trying to get one thing to do multiple jobs, whether that's a person or a sales system or even a business model. I mean, in the end, I think one needs to reverse engineer from the aims that I process a person or a software tool or a platform or even an entire business has in your life or your business. So yeah, if your aim is get your VAT sorted, just employ somebody to deal with that. And VAT returns, by the way, in the UK, and it varies across Europe, I'm sure you've experienced this, but yeah, in the UK, it's once a quarter. So you'll need somebody who can fill it in once a quarter, and you know, it's not a huge daily or weekly stress either. So it's not like you're going to be paying somebody the whole time. But so what do you think are the other barriers that you've seen that get in the way of North Americans selling into Europe, and I guess starting with the UK?
I think it's two things. One, it's the VAT, and I've got a couple other tips for VAT from an entrepreneur's perspective, not from a tax person's perspective. But also the other one is just the fear of, will it work out? So I've got tips for both of those. So when it comes to VAT, sometimes I've heard people have like fears like, oh my gosh, it's going to cost me all this money to do it. Now, one of the things I will say is Amazon, I love Amazon. I think Amazon is great. There's a lot of great people at Amazon. And anytime Amazon contacts you, you pick up the phone and you listen to what they have to say. One thing I will say from my own experience, having lived through this, is oftentimes Amazon is going to request that you do what's called pan-European. So what that means is, just to take a step back, the simplest way to say if you have VAT requirements is if you're outside of Europe and you are shipping goods into a European country, i.e. the UK, and you're storing it in that country, then you are required to register and file for VAT. Let's say you could theoretically, most people don't realize this is even possible, what's called the European Fulfillment Network, you could send in your goods into the UK. You will pay at the border to the UK government, which you can subtract later on from what you owe them in VAT. And then if somebody buys from your listing on, let's say, Amazon.it, which is Italy, because you had it translated and put up in the Italian version of Amazon, Amazon could ship your inventory from the UK to the customer in Italy. Now, what Amazon wants to do is they want to be able to move stuff around to be able to get it to the customer faster, because Amazon's all about the customer experience. And I understand where they're coming from with this, because in the US, the mentality is, if I ship goods, let's say from Florida to Charlotte, North Carolina, which seems to be where they constantly tell me to send stuff, they'll send some of that to Illinois. They'll send some of it to Nebraska or wherever else they have fulfillment centers. They want to be able to do the same thing in Europe. But the problem is, in Europe, is going back to what I said before, if you're storing in a European country, you're now responsible for VAT in that country. So Amazon will only move stuff around if you let them. And that's what's called the pan-European program. Now, the issue with that is you have to not just be registered in the UK, you have to be registered in 7 countries. Even though there's 5 marketplaces, there's 7 countries that have fulfillment centers. And that includes also Poland and Czech Republic. And what happens is, to your point, you only have to file once a quarter in the UK. In France, Poland, and the Czech Republic, you're doing it basically every month. And what happens is, unlike the US, where it's based on where the customer lives, in Europe, it's all about where the goods were dispatched from. So where it was shipped from is what we would say in the US. But if it's dispatched from, let's say, the Czech Republic to someone in Germany, for example, then you would owe the VAT to the German government. And the problem there is the cost of compliance could be like maybe another 6,600 euros. So that's like another $7,000 plus that you'd be paying. And you save a little bit on fulfillment fees by doing pan-European, but I don't find it's worth it, especially for the investment of time and going back to the registrations are now more complicated. Even if you have someone helping you with it, it's very complex because things don't work quite the same in non-English common law countries. So my recommendation is to keep it simple, and you can always grow in complexity, but start in the UK. And then when you're ready, go into Germany. But don't send your goods into Germany. Just let it fulfill from the UK. And you, if someone, going back to where it dispatches from, is where you owe the VAT, generally speaking. So then if you know somebody in Germany buys your product and it ships from Manchester or wherever else in the UK that they have fulfillment centers, you would owe the UK government. And it's fairly simple that way. And one of the things I also like about the UK is, the way it has been explained to me, it's one of the only countries that has what's called a flat rate scheme. And normally in the US, when we think of the word scheme, we think someone's being indicted on federal charges, meaning that they're going to get arrested and go to jail. Scheme, in what I have found in the UK, just means method of accounting. So the flat rate scheme basically means, just to say, let's just walk through quick math. The normal standard scheme would be, let's say you're selling a product for £12. So we talked about before, generally speaking, in the UK, it's 20%. So the way that's divided, you're not taking 12 times 20%. You're really dividing it up between £10 is the price and £2 is the VAT. So it's kind of like what we were talking about, the beer being sold in a stadium, because it's the taxes included. And then with that £2 that you're owing to the government, you will subtract out whatever you've paid into the system, which generally speaking is going to be what you paid at the border. Maybe if you had a prep company helping you with prep, and maybe potentially if you might be paying some VAT on your PPC. But what I have found is much simpler is you can register under the flat rate scheme as an online retailer where you're only having to pay 7.5% if you register under the right, they call it SIC code, I forget what it stands for, basically industry code for an online retailer, meaning instead of owing the government 20%, you're owing them 7.5%. Now, the math is not exactly the same, so it'd be basically £12 in our example of a product times 0.075, and that's what you owe, but you don't have to figure out what you paid in and what you pay out, because sometimes it can get kind of complicated, and sometimes there's exceptions to the rule of what you can and can't and what forms you're supposed to have technically if you're going to get audited. So having worked it out with a VASC, it just made sense for me to go in the flat rate scheme. And so I suggest people do that. And sometimes it maybe doesn't totally work out in their favor to be on the flat rate scheme. Sometimes it does, but I like the simplicity of it. So that's one of my suggestions, is to go in the flat rate scheme.
That's very, very good. Anything that creates simplicity means that you get over the barrier. You can, as you say, you can always get more complex later. So just to revise a couple of things you say, I mean, I don't know if it's a good or bad habit that I do this. I suppose it's a teachery habit to repeat important stuff, but I want people to go away and be able to feel like they can take action on this stuff. So forgive me saying it again, but yeah, the pan-European thing, as you say, is not a starting point. That's something to do once you've expanded your sales to the point where you really, it makes sense to go through the hassle and expense of registering for VAT, say in Germany, which is generally is the second biggest marketplace in the world, in Amazon's world, bigger than the UK by a big margin, not as big as the US, of course. But that might be one of the first places where you might consider doing that. And yeah, you're going to have some expense and hassle associated with that. But as you said, the European Fulfillment Network, the EFN, does mean you can just import stuff into UK. And then just if stuff sells in Italy, France, Germany, Spain, then great. Then it gets fulfilled by Amazon. They'll charge you a bit more because, of course, it's going further, which is fair enough. And it's a slight barrier to a sale. But on the other hand, it's minimizing risk and complexity. So I couldn't agree more. And that would be, by the way, my own suggestion as well for UK-based sellers, exactly the same. Just ship it into a UK-based fulfillment center. And then get your listings translated, or even allow Amazon to do the translation, which is normally pretty horrible, but that's better than not being there.
Yeah.
And put it up in Germany. And if it sells, it just gets fulfilled from the UK because it's not being stored in Germany. I mean, it's a bit of a gray area, but mostly not. Then it's not going to be subject to VAT. And actually, if you're UK based, the great news is that you can expand internationally without any kind of VAT registration at all. If you're doing under £85,000 a year in revenue, or so over $100,000, if you're a UK based company, if you're a US citizen and you own a UK based company, that sounds quite complex to me. I don't know how that works. So you'd have to look into it. What I would say as well is, if you can set open a UK company, if you haven't done it before, or if you're US based, UK companies for British citizens anyway, incredibly quick and easy to set up. I mean, it costs me literally about £20 or $30, and you can do it in an hour online, and it's up and ready in 5 hours. It's extraordinarily quick. I understand that in many states in America, it could take months, need the expensive attorney's fees and stuff. So again, it can be simpler than you think. If you're American and you want to open a UK company, I don't know how that works. But as you said, I wouldn't bother. I would just keep it as simple as possible and expand when it looks worth expanding, because some stuff will work and some won't, right? So starting with complexity and ending with success sounds like the wrong way around to me. Start with a simple version. So this is great. I mean, I think really helpful and really sort of, what's the word? Consoling advice that is actually easier than people think. Tell me briefly, well, I think we're going to break out into another episode. That sounds terribly like some time to get very woken with the kids, but I think we will talk in another episode about Europe as a slightly separate thing, because from Americans, it may seem like one big lumpy mess, but actually it's not the same as UK. And we'll talk about Canada and Australia separately, because they're the kind of interesting countries. But any final things just about the UK, if you're a North American based, American or Canadian, I guess we're talking primarily, then what are the other hints that will simplify your start in the UK in your experience?
One of the nice things is, generally speaking, most of the tools that people are used to using, i.e. Jungle Scout, they also work in Europe. So you can look and see and get a general sense. It's not perfect, of course, but you can get a general sense for, are similar products to yours working? That's one of the things I think is really good.
Yes, and I think that not only can you do that, but you should do fresh keyword research in every single marketplace. One of the things I would say, that just there's the obvious differences. Well, I say obvious to Brits, but maybe Americans aren't aware that the word pants kind of makes Brits snigger, because that's what you wear underneath what you would call pants and what I would call trousers. And there's quite a few important differences, like the word color is spelt with a U in the UK, and little differences like that. But also in different marketplaces, people happen to use different words for things. Even if they happen to be the exact same words, they may not be as popular in the UK. A search term like, I know, ballpoint pen might be very popular in the UK, and it might mean exactly the same in the USA, but just not be a very good search term. It might be too competitive in the US, but okay in the UK. It's not a good example. It's a terrible example, but you get the idea. iPhone case black, iPhone X, or something like very specific like that. So I think you always have to do fresh keyword research, but you're quite right. All the tools generally work in all the marketplaces, except, of course, Japan, famously. But yeah, that's a worthwhile thing to say. I would say, for Americans that I know who've sold into UK, it's not been too traumatic an experience. Trying to get your head around VAT before you know what you're doing is the biggest barrier, I think, that I agree with that. And I think a lot of it is just in your head, because once you get your head around how it works with a good accountant, they'll sort it out for you. So you don't really need to worry about it. You just need to look at your profit and loss. It's either money coming in or it's money going out in the end of the day. So it's not hard. The profit is the difference between what you bring in and what you pay out, right? So the details of that, I think you're wise to hire an accountant who's a specialist and then just let them worry about it. I don't think it's that complex.
Yeah, I agree. And you said a word earlier that kind of triggered something in my mind, those complicated, making things less complicated. And some of it too is, or no, I'm sorry, it was competitive. That's the word you used. But basically, the thing I would say is the US is the most competitive, because you had mentioned keywords might not be as competitive in one marketplace versus the other. Generally speaking, everything's more competitive, generally speaking, in most cases in the US, because that's the shiny penny. That's where everybody's going after. That's what everyone wants. So what I would say is, a lot of people don't want to jump through the hoops, i.e. fill out the form or have to file quarterly or whatever they have to do to sell in international marketplaces like Europe or Canada or wherever else. So they don't even bother. But the thing of it is, let's say your product, just with the, you know, pricing is for everyone else, that if you started looking at what it would cost you to sell in Europe and factor in VAT, because it's included in the price, your margins might be less. But at the end of the day, you're not taking margins to the bank. You're taking money to the bank. And again, it's sixth grade level math to figure it out. And the nice thing is, you're casting a wider net, so you're going to catch more fish. And the people, i.e. future customers that are in Europe or Canada or wherever, they're not in the US. They're not going on Amazon.com. There's a lot of people that are very exclusive to their own marketplace because, and this is what maybe a lot of people don't quite understand, is if you live in the UK, you can theoretically shop on Amazon.com, but it's going to take a couple weeks for things to arrive. You're going to pay more in shipping. You're going to have to convert things to dollars, you know, to pay, which maybe that your credit card company might charge you international fees or whatever the case is. Or you can go into Amazon.co.uk, buy something, and the shipping seems to be even faster within the UK than it is within the US. And the crazy thing is, I was on this webinar, and if you ship something into a UK fulfillment center, from the time it's checked in, they can have it to the customer in 4 hours. That's insane. So
yeah,
much better experience for the customer within their own marketplace.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I sell on Amazon. I help people sell on Amazon. I run masterminds about Amazon. I shop on Amazon all the time. I got a delivery this afternoon. It wouldn't even occur to me to buy something on Amazon.com. And in fact, I can't. I'm going to have a Kindle account that's linked with Amazon.co.uk. Every so often, I have a guest who's launching a new book and they'll send me a link. And I'll say, yeah, that's very sweet, but I can't buy that. It's on Amazon.com. I could use my business. I could use my Amazon company's accounts that obviously has got a Seller Central account in Amazon.com. But it's just, why go through the hoops? I mean, it's just, yeah, in a way, that is a barrier. It's not about the distance. It's about it is about the distance of the fulfillment. This is not about the problem from the seller's perspective of shipping goods around the world, which is a barrier in people's minds, which doesn't make sense because it takes the same time and money and effort to get goods from the East Coast of China across the Pacific to LA or wherever on the West Coast of the States, as roughly it takes to Europe, about the same. Whereas as a consumer, obviously, I don't want to wait for 2 weeks and I don't want to have to deal with conversions and, you know, everything's in inches and pounds. And, you know, in theory, British people are very schizophrenic about that. They kind of use metric and imperial measurements, as we call it, interchangeably. But yeah, the whole thing is geared to the person there. And you're right. I mean, I have to say there's a lot of people in the masterminds that I run that sell in the US and the UK. Now, most of them are British based. But it's interesting that it's for sure that the more profitable businesses generally find the profit comes from the UK, even though the turnover can look very impressive in the US. The revenue is very, you know, big, impressive number to bandy around at meetings. But actually, the profit's always a challenge because it's so hyper-competitive. So that's absolutely true. And it might be a welcome break from that hyper-competition if you've been used to Amazon.com.
Yeah, and I've found from my own experience and just in anecdotally talking with others, people do all these, you know, giveaways and stuff in the US, and it seems like they don't necessarily even get the same results if they go internationally doing all these giveaways. Sometimes it's better off just turning on PPC and going, because again, it's not as competitive. You're not fighting with all these people. So to your point, to launch a product is a lot easier. And one of the other nice things about going internationally is if you have reviews on a product on Amazon.com, to start, those will carry over into the international marketplaces. It seems to be kind of mixed as to whether or not it'll show up on the search page. I've noticed in my own experience that sometimes it'll show it, sometimes it won't. It'll pretty much always show your Amazon reviews on the listing page of the product. And then once you start getting reviews in that home country, those will take precedence. But you're not starting from scratch with zero social proof. Point being, and the nice thing is, and you can correct me on this, but I would say people in other countries are used to seeing customers on Amazon.com also said whatever, and that's usually right below the local reviews.
Yeah, I guess we are used to seeing that. And it's true. And it doesn't work the other way around either. So you can't launch in the UK and get your review shows on Amazon.com, but definitely does work the other way. And in fact, in some ways, you hope that somebody isn't going to put up a review for a while, because it looks like you got 12 stars average reviews when somebody's got, and their Amazon.com listing has 12 stars, for example, 12 reviews and 5-star average. And you just hope that your first few reviews in the new marketplace are good, because then they take over after that. So yeah, the only disadvantage is in things like you've got American reviews showing in Germany, but then a lot of Germans do speak English, and you know, it's a lot better, as you said, than having no social proof. So yeah, you, once you've launched on Amazon.com, it really is a great sort of launch pad for launching in other places. I absolutely agree with that. So let's wrap that episode up here, because I think we ought to keep it sort of bite-sized. Well, it's like a healthy meal-sized rather than meal-sized, but meal-sized, you know, but American-sized meal.
Lunch.
Yeah. So, but the next one, we're going to talk about launching the Rarer marketplace. I think we've touched on continental Europe. I think the main thing that interests me is, I think Canada and Australia, particularly Canada, people don't talk about it very much. And we'll touch on Japan as well, because those are places that I feel, you know, get ignored. So let's look at the Cinderella marketplaces next. But for the moment, Kevin, thank you so much for your very, very helpful guidance on mostly getting North Americans over the gap of going to the UK. But it's not as big a deal as you think. Everything's a pain. And the last thing I would say is, if you think launching a USA is comfortable just because it's your country, then I would say import taxes and Trump, and I would say sales tax. And if you Google those for 10 minutes, you'll know why that means it's way more complicated than VAT.
Right, exactly.
100, literally. So let's weigh it up. Weigh it up in some kind of context. Anyway, thanks very much for your excellent thoughts.
Thanks for having me.
That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.